Good evening. Good evening and a very warm welcome to all of you. It's a great pleasure to have you all here for the final global debate in our project 10 Years of Urban Age. We organized this jointly by the Alfred Herzen Society, which I represent, and LSE Cities. And let me say a word about ourselves. We are the International Forum of Deutsche Bank, and we are founded in memory of the assassinated former CEO and philosopher Alfred Herrhausen. And what we want to do is to promote the exchange of ideas and examine the key issues of our time. We like to say that we look for traces of the future in the present. One, of course, of the key issues is urbanization. Our megacities today are microcosms of all the big issues of our time, be it climate change, scarcity of resources, energy, infrastructure, social justice, social cohesion, everything. And if we want to shape the future, you have to shape the cities. And this is what we're trying to help tackling through the Urban Age program. Now, for 10 years, Urban Age has been investigating spatial and social dynamics of cities, and we have organized 13 conferences in 13 different megacities around the world. And now, during the past events, the past 10 days, we have thanked each other profusely. Everybody has thanked LSE Cities, but I haven't. So let me say thank you, Ricky, thank you, Philip, thanks the whole team for what you have done with us and for us in the last 10 years, and especially what you are going to do with us in the coming years. Now, the goal of the Global Debate Series has been to discuss five core themes which have been the focus of research and the debate of Urban Age since 2005. For instance, Nick Stern, Karen Seto, and Bruce Katz discussed the role that cities can play in confronting climate change. Juan Kloss, Alejandro Aravena, and others looked at the role of planning and architecture in steering urban growth. Saskia Sassen made a passionate statement on the new patterns of ownership and its negative impacts on cityness. And Norman Foster presented how infrastructure can be used to improve the quality of life in cities. But as you can imagine, it doesn't end here. In fact, the plans for the upcoming year once again underline the role that the Urban Age has played and will continue to play in informing the international discourse. Urban Age will curate a pavilion as well as host an Urban Age conference at next year's Biennale, the Architectural Biennale in Venice, and it will organize a session at Habitat 3 in Quito on the relationship between public and private spaces. But let's turn to tonight. Tonight, I have the incredible pleasure to welcome three people who have shaped the ideas over the years. We have Richard Sennett, who will be introduced like Sukito Mehta later on, but let me say a personal word. Richard has been the spiritus rector of the whole enterprise. He constantly has infused us with new ideas, and we count on him in the future. He's been with us for 10 years. So has Sukito Mehta. And when I first read the book Bombay Maximum City, after having lived 7 years in India, for the first time I understood that a city is not brick and mortar, that a city is an ever-ongoing epic Shakespearean saga of people, of tragedy, happiness, and life. And finally, the chair tonight, Dame Tessa Jowell. I have had the chance to learn from her, to admire her when she was Secretary for Culture, but her special contribution to Urban Age was as Minister for the Olympics. because afterwards we did an Urban Age conference in Rio about the question, what does a mega event like Olympics do to a city, to the social cohesion of a city? And if the Rio Olympics will be a success, then it's due to her. If there won't be a success, it's because they haven't heeded the advice. So with that, Tessa, over to you. Thank you.
Oh, Thomas, thank you. Thank you for the wonderful and generous way you've presided, not over this series of Urban Age lectures and events, but throughout the programme. We're enormously grateful to you. Now, this evening's session, I hope you will all feel, will conclude, raise more questions than deliberately than it will answer. So you will go home thinking about the answers to how we reconcile the major debates about city form, infrastructure, the role of planning, with the humanity of cities, and how that magic impulse is created, which means that space is provided, opportunity is created, and city dwellers, the citizens of the city, actually take it as theirs. And in order to, I hope that as you're listening to Richard and Suketu, you will think about the places that you live, the places that you visited, so that you can begin to connect the ideas with your own daily lived experience. So I'm incredibly excited about this session, incredibly excited, because, you know, we're lucky enough to have on this platform two of the world's leading thinkers on precisely this set of questions. And going first is Suketu. Yep, is Suketu Mehta. Now, Suketu, his own description of himself is as a writer, an Indian who moved to America and likes cities. So I'm absolutely sure that in what he says to you, you'll discover a bit more about his biography. And our second, who needs, I suspect, very little introduction, because you'll have read all his work, Richard Senate, Richard is a very dear friend of mine, and he rather modestly describes himself as chair of the advisory committee of LSE Cities. But I will leave hanging in the air everything else that Richard's done to shape this debate, make us understand more, and enable us to live in better cities than might otherwise be the case. So we're going to hear from each Suketu and then Richard in turn. They will each speak for about 20 minutes. Richard has a terrible, terrible throat, so you've got to just make allowances for that and temper the brutality of your questions afterwards to take account of that. And then we'll move into a discussion between the two of them and then bring you into that conversation as well. So it's my great pleasure to invite Suketu to open our discussion this evening.
Thank you so much, Tessa, for that generous introduction, and to Thomas and Richard, who I've been reading since I was an undergraduate at NYU, where we now both teach, so it's a great honor to share a stage with you. And thank you all for coming. I've been spending a lot of time in New York's Coney Island because it's the capital of fun, the people's playground. If you sit on the boardwalk in Coney Island and watch the everyday carnival of all the races of the earth strolling together without knowing much about each other, The hipsters in leather, the Bangladeshis in hijab, the Russians in bikinis. Then you realize the great secret about why Coney Island works. It's not that everyone is included. It's that no one is excluded. It's not that you'll get invited to every party on the beach. It's that somewhere on the beach, there's a party you can go to. New York, like Rio, like Mumbai, is booming. Things seem to be going well for these cities. But who exactly is it going well for? To build a great city, a just city, we have to look at who's included and who's excluded. Then we should follow three principles. Don't exclude anybody from the law. Don't exclude anybody from the conversation. And don't exclude anybody from the celebration. There's a store near where I live in New York, in Soho, where you can buy a Swedish bed made of horsehair for $135,000, not including delivery. It's called the Vividus, and it comes with two metal plates affixed to the mattress in your choice of nickel or brass, inscribed with your name and your bedmate's name, so that if you stumble home drunk, you can look to see which side of the bed you're supposed to be sleeping, like a place sitting at a dinner party, and who you're supposed to be sleeping with. 15 minutes walk from this store, I can take you to a tenement in Chinatown, where you rent not an apartment, not a room in the apartment, not a bed in the room in the apartment, but an 8-hour shift on the mattress in the room in the apartment for $200 a month. It's called a hot bed because the bed is never cold. When you wake up, there's always someone else standing over you waiting to come home. What does it mean for a city in which people sleep in such radically different beds? It means Bill de Blasio gets elected mayor of New York in 2014 with his powerful message of two cities. So the first principle, don't exclude anyone from the law. The most important form of exclusion these days is in housing. Who gets to live in a city? The great success of New York also begs the question, what happened to the good people who stayed through the bad times? What happened to the people in Fort Greene, Astoria, Bedford Stuyvesant, who kept faith with the city through decades of crack, bankruptcy, and garbage strikes? When I lived in the East Village in the 1990s, the area still had a number of squatters who were living peaceably in the buildings abandoned during the crack epidemic of the 1980s. But crack was on its way out, and so the squatters had to be too. One day, the NYPD brought in a platoon of cops in riot gear, some of them riding in an actual tank, and cleared the hippies out. The parking lot next to my building turned into a luxury condominium rented out to energetic young white people who went off to work in law firms and banks downtown. The lobby of the condominium now displays giant black and white documentary photographs of the grungy Lower East Side, of the squatters and derelicts that the building displaced. All around Lower Manhattan, older buildings, often rent-controlled tenements, artists' lofts, or garment factories, are being torn down and condominiums coming up in the West Village, on the Bowery, in Soho, and across their facades in prominent fonts, the city's inequality and your poverty gets rubbed in your face. Quote, 12 individually curated residences starting at $3 million. Where thousands once worked, a dozen will now get to live. And they won't even live there full time. Many of the owners have multiple such residences around the world, so very few of the lights will be on in the building at any given time. The text in the ads for these buildings makes for fascinating reading, like a love letter addressed to you, if only you had more money. A brochure for a real estate firm, Corcoran, slips out from my morning paper. Among the offerings is a 4,000-square-foot apartment in the Time Warner building, for $50 million. Quote, finding a new home can be like taking a new lover without leaving your current one, the brochure says. There is nothing like falling in love. Can a city be too successful for its own good, where the crime is low, the subways run on time, the culture is world-class, the restaurants Michelin-starred? Yes, for that means you won't be able to afford living in it. It is one thing to be excluded if you're a newcomer to the city. It is another to be excluded in the city where your family has lived for four generations by people who are just getting off the plane from Berlin or Paris. I recently walked around a slum close to the river in Istanbul, which is fast gentrifying. I spoke to the owner of a long-established cafe there, who told me, "I want my kids to be the fourth generation to be born here." That seems unlikely, because right across the street from him was another cafe, popular among the new artists who've been coming into the area. He told me that the artists have their own cafes. They don't mix with the neighborhood. They bring their own culture to the neighborhood. They don't participate in the existing culture of the neighborhood. That made me think, if I were living in a rent-controlled apartment in a rough neighborhood, and I wanted to make sure my rent would continue to stay low, I would shoot the first artist that moved onto my block. Because after the artists come the bankers that want to date the artist, and pretty soon your rent doubles.
I think there's a Hoxton contingent here.
It's not just poor people who are getting excluded from the city. When you have the second child, you're out. An upper middle class friend of mine in Brooklyn noted, "It's become punitive," said another friend, a relatively well-off mother who can't afford private schools and doesn't trust the public schools. Will the children of suburbanites, after they find a mate in the city, stay in the city when they have their own children? Cities like San Francisco and Berlin are finding that families with children are fleeing the city to find bigger houses and better schools. Between 2000 and 2010, the number of children below 14 actually dropped in U.S. cities of over 500,000 residents. The biggest drops were in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. Chicago has 145,000 fewer school-aged children today than it did a decade ago. A city without children is a melancholy thing, like a forest without songbirds. Should a city cede control of its limited real estate to people who don't actually live there? According to the Census Bureau, 30% of all the apartments between 49th and 70th Streets from 5th to Park Avenue in New York are vacant at least 10 months of the year. We are seeing this phenomenon of empty quarters within cities all over the world. The causes vary: rent frozen by law in Mumbai at 1944 rates, apartments bought by overseas speculators in New York and London that they prefer to keep empty, the takeover by social protest movements of whole buildings in downtown Sao Paulo, buildings which everyone else then flees from. In Rio, there are lots of guards now in the newly pacified favelas. The state specification program, which has liberated the favela residents from the despotism of the drug traffickers, has also made them safe for gentrification. Rents, in some cases, have tripled after pacification. I've met young Europeans and Americans who are living in Cantagalo and Hacienda, enthusiastic about the great views and the vibrant cultural scene. All that is wonderful. The favelas need to be more integrated into the rest of the city. As long as the young Europeans and Americans and the young Brazilians from outside the favelas don't push out the people who kept them alive and vibrant when they were dangerous and drug-infested. Quote, "Gentrification is like cholesterol," points out our friend Amanda Burden, who, as head of city planning under Mayor Bloomberg, rezoned one out of every five blocks in the city. There's good gentrification and bad gentrification. We need to take a look at who is included and excluded from the law. Great cities flourish when they permit an accommodative illegality. The problem right now is that the law can be stretched or even outright flouted by the rich, as we see in the epic land grab taking place in the Mumbai mill areas, a land grab retroactively approved by the Supreme Court, but is inflexible for the poor. The poor live in a state of permanent legal insecurity, never knowing what law will be enforced when, as we see in slum colonies all over the world. The second principle, don't exclude anyone from the conversation. The conversation around urbanism these days is like the Latin mass, laden with jargon, reinforcing the barriers around the professional guild. The debates of the planners sound like buildings talking to buildings. As a result, people don't listen to good and smart planners in Mumbai or Mexico City because the planners don't speak in a language that people can understand, or they speak only international languages like English and Mandarin and not local languages like Marathi or Fujianese. I know of no joint programs between university departments of urban planning and departments of journalism. I know of very few writers or journalists who really understand the workings of cities. And the ones that do don't know how to translate it into a story that will grab ordinary readers leafing through the gossip pages. Meanwhile, the real estate developers invest in professional storytellers to sell their glass towers and shopping malls to a gullible populace. If philosophers or literary theorists write incomprehensible jargon, it might hinder the rest of the populace's ability to comprehend philosophy of literature, but it's not really going to affect their daily lives. But when it comes to urban planners, their dreams could become our nightmares. The rest of us have to walk in them, sleep in them, live in them. We need to understand the story they're selling us. It is critical for planners to go out from the academies into the public sphere to tell people in Mumbai why you can't fight traffic by building a giant new bridge, because all it does is get you to your traffic jam faster. Or to tell the people living in gated communities in Istanbul, which is one of the safest cities in Europe, that if they actually look at what they're paying every month for security guards, they would realize it's cheaper to get mugged every month. I'm arguing for the critical importance of the urban planner as public intellectual. Because without political will, all our grand city plans will remain on the drawing board. And political will can only be generated if we get the public informed and excited about planning. The third principle, don't exclude anyone from the celebration. Cities are enormously unequal places today. The richest 5% of New Yorkers earn 88 times as much as the poorest 20%. The paradox is that in spite of this, moving to the city is the most effective way for the poor to improve their standard of living. In the US, cities like Detroit and Baltimore, places that don't have a lot of diversity in terms of ethnicity, or that have tied themselves to a single industry, are stagnating. But cities like New York, which actively encourage immigration, are doing better than ever before. 2 out of 3 New Yorkers today are immigrants or their children. Cities could be reaching out to immigrants, putting out the welcome mat. The value of ethnic diversity, like culture, is one of those intangibles that are difficult to measure in economic terms. But many of the software engineers and designers and the creative class that make cities attractive are widely traveled and want to hear many languages spoken on the street. They want a choice of pupusas or parathas for dinner. So ethnic diversity can revitalize these old industrial cities across the richer countries, make downtown central again, and add a new spice in the mix. And human beings like our city spicy. Our young people come to cities in search not just of love, but of danger. They go out of their way to walk through the possibly threatening park, have drinks in the sleazy nightclub, live in the dodgy immigrant area. It is part of the thrill of urban living to those who've grown up in a suburb where the greatest danger comes from cops raiding a party in search of potheads. Metropolitan excitement, a chaotic sense of possibility, flouting of zoning codes, shops spilling out into the sidewalk, a frisson of danger. All these things collectively make up what distinguishes a city from a suburb, hubbub. By this late date in human civilization, most of us in the safe, rich countries are bored. Suburbs are boring. So programmed are they, so controlled by laws and codes and rules that the human being withers. When I walk about the city, I'm alert for the eccentric, the unpredictable, even the manageably unsafe. Every time I get mugged, I get a story out of it. When I go to cities around the world, I seek out this hubbub. So the list of the world's, quote, most livable cities compiled by the financial magazines are a joke. They are made for expat bankers. 7 of the top 10 countries in the Economist Intelligence Unit's 2015 Global Livability Ranking are in Australia or Canada. The pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong last year resulted in a 3.2% decline in the livability ranking. Quote, Hong Kong's livability has been hit by the disruptive protests that took place last year, pronounced the EIU survey editor. So, democratic protest means a city is unlivable. By that standard, the ideal city would be Pyongyang. Canberra, Geneva, Calgary are beautiful and deadly boring. They do well on the lists because they are mostly cleansed of immigrants, the poor, the necessary chaos that is the first marker of big city life. The expectation that, in Joan Didion's words, quote, something extraordinary would happen any minute, any day, any month. A great city has the ability to, as Bob Marley urges, stir it up. The two great forces that are going to stir it up in the 21st century are mass migration and inequality. You think 4 million Syrian refugees fleeing from war is a big deal? What happens when climate change really kicks in and Bangladesh gets flooded and 100 million Bangladeshis look for dry land? They'll be coming soon to a city near you. And as they do, rich people all across the globe will look to channel popular rage about inequality at the most vulnerable scapegoats, migrants. The greatest challenge facing cities worldwide is accommodation, in all senses of the word. Greater Bombay has over 20 million people, and parts of the inner city have a population density of over 1 million people per square mile. How the hell do all these people live together? New York is panicked because it's projected that it will add 1 million people over the next 20 years. It will go from 8 to 9 million people. Bombay adds 1 million people every year. I realized when I was doing my book about Bombay that the way Bombay survives is by a series of solidarity networks among the poor. The manager of Bombay's suburban railway system was once asked when the system would improve to a point where it could carry its 6 million daily passengers in comfort. Not in my lifetime, he answered. Certainly, if you commute into Bombay, you are made aware of the precise temperature of the human body as it curls around you on all sides, adjusting itself to every curve of your own. A lover's embrace was never so close. My friend Asad bin Saif works in an institute for secularism, moving tirelessly among the slums, cataloging numberless communal flare-ups and riots, seeing firsthand the slow destruction of the social fabric of the city. Asad is from Bhagalpur in Bihar, site not only of some of the worst communal rioting in the nation, but also of a gory incident where the police blinded a group of petty criminals with knitting needles and acid. Asad, of all people, has seen humanity at its worst. I asked him if he feels pessimistic about the human race. Not at all, he responded. Look at the hands from the trains. If you are late for work in the morning in Bombay and you reach the station just as the train is leaving the platform, you can run up to the packed compartments and you will find many hands stretching out to grab you on board, unfolding outward from the train like petals. And as you run alongside the train, you will be picked up and some tiny space will be made for your feet on the edge of the open doorway. The rest is up to you. You'll probably have to hang on to the door frame with your fingertips, being careful not to lean out too far lest you get decapitated by a pole placed too close to the tracks. But consider what has happened. Your fellow passengers, already packed tighter than cattle are legally allowed to be, their shirts already drenched in sweat in the badly ventilated compartment, having stood like this for hours, retain an empathy for you, know that your boss might yell at you or cut your pay if you miss this train, and will make space where none exists to take one more person with them. And at the moment of contact, they do not know if the hand that is reaching for theirs belongs to a Hindu or Muslim or Christian or Brahmin or untouchable, or whether you were born in the city or arrived only this morning, or whether you live in Malabar Hill or Jogeshwari, whether you're from Bombay or Mumbai or New York. All they know is that you're trying to get to the city of gold, and that's enough. Come on board, they say. We'll adjust. Thank you.
So, Keto, I think as well as being challenging, that was just enchanting. Thank you very much indeed. And now we're going to hear from Richard. And Richard has developed a rather wonderfully enticing idea of the poorest city. So he's going to take us, first of all, to Nehru Place in Delhi.
That's it. You have to forgive me. I know I can get through this talk, but you just have to be you have to be patient with me. I'm going to talk about an idea that I've been thinking about for a long time, called the poorest city. And maybe I can explain it concretely in the following way. Recently, I tried to buy an iPhone in Nehru Place, an open-air electronics market in Delhi, where goods that happen to have fallen off a truck are sold for 30%, 40%, or 70% discounts, whatever cash you have handy. My iPhone turned out to be a damaged dud, but I didn't really care. The experience of going to Nehru Place was eye-opening. I'll show you another picture of it. It's a completely porous spot in the city. People of all castes, classes, races, and religions coming and going, doing deals on phones or gossiping about the small tech startups in the low offices around the square. That's above. You can see on the second floor is an above. You can also worship at a small shrine if you're so minded, or find a sari, or just lounge about drinking tea. Nehru Place is every urbanist's dream, intense, mixed, complex. If it's the sort of place we want to make, it's not, however, the sort of space most cities are building. Instead, the dominant forms of urban growth are monofunctional, like shopping centers where you are welcome to shop, but there's no place to pray. These sorts of places tend to be isolated in space, as in the office campuses built on the edge of cities, or towers in a city's center, which, as in London's current crop of architectural monsters, I say no more, are sealed off at the base from the surroundings. Can I remark? It's amazing to walk among these spaces. You can't get into any of them. They're all sealed. They're glass boxes. You can look inside, but it's not for you. It's not just evil developers, however, who want things this way. The most popular form of residential housing worldwide is the gated community. Is it worth trying to turn the dream of the poorest city into a pervasive reality? I wondered in Nehru Place about the social side of this question, since Indian cities have been swept from time to time by waves of ethnic and religious violence. Could porous places tamp down that threat by mixing people together in everyday activities? Evidence from Western cities answers both yes and no. In Dresden, last year's Pegida demonstrations against the Muslim presence in Germany, for instance, in that, Pegida argued that Muslim culture is alien to Western values. This argument was turned out to be made by people in Pegida who don't live anywhere near Muslims in the city, indeed who know no Muslims. So they're completely separated. The American social scientist Robert Putnam adds a seemingly contradictory, ironic twist to the separation in space of different social groups. In a study of several cities, his researchers found that the further away white Americans live from African Americans, the more tolerant the whites are. That is, the closer you are, the more intolerant. So these are two contrary facts. They don't fit together. It's yes or no. Against this logic of separation stands Paris. The Islamic banlieue of Paris are separated from the center by the Ceinture, the ever-clogged ring road around the inner city. And so too in Brussels' Molenbeek district, from which many of the terrorists come. It's a disconnected island in the city. As the sociologist William Julius Wilson has shown, such physical islands breed an inward-looking mentality in which fantasy about others takes the place of fact bred of actual contact. As true, Wilson argues, of the black ghetto as it is of Christian Pegida. Now, I have to say about this that I'm deeply uncomfortable about debates over separation and inclusion, which move almost seamlessly to citing violent, extreme behavior as evidence for or against. This is just wrong socially, which is why Nehru Place is a better place to think about inclusion than Molenbeek. Every day, people are going about their business with others unlike themselves. People they don't know, perhaps people they don't like. There is what might be called the democracy of crime here, as Hindus and Muslims both sell illegal electronics. A wave of violence would clear off customers for both. Getting along in this kind of environment isn't particular to India or to open-air markets. Numerous studies show that in offices or factories, that adults of different religions and races work perfectly well together, and the reason is not far to seek. I want to explain this. I've just got to have more of this water. I know I'm going to get there. Just bear with me for a second. Work is not about affirming your identity. It's about getting things done. The complexity of city life tends, in fact, to breed many identities for its citizens, as workers, but also as spectators at sports events, as parents concerned about schooling or patients suffering from NHS cuts. Urban identities are porous in the sense that we are always going in and out of lots of different experiences in different places with people we don't know in the course of a single day. When pundits opine on the difficulty of difference, they flatten identity into a single image, just one experience. The modern economy can then flatten identity when it sells people on the idea of the gated homogeneous community as safe, which is not true in fact, or builds shopping centers only for shopping, or constructs office campuses and towers whose workers are sealed off from the city. So this is a problem for this. This is a debate about purified identity. It's not a debate which makes any sense about work, nor about forms of leisure, where the problem of difference and integration just doesn't arrive. It's, as Cicada says, it's a question about the meaning of home. And the meaning of home is synonymous with a kind of homogenizing of identity. You can see where I'm going. In order to make the city more tolerant, we should have a less strong identification with home. We should learn how to use the city and live in the city in a more impersonal way. It's why I've argued against the many, many projects that seek to strengthen community. That's a way of strengthening and flattening home. We belong here, even if the we is very many different people. It's still saying this is a particular place, and this is with the place with which I identify. Now, I want to just say for a bit, I hope I haven't talked too long.
You're fine, Richard.
Okay, if the public comes to demand it, urbanists can easily design a porous city on the model of Nehru Place. And indeed, many of the architects and planners at the Urban Age events now unfolding in London have made proposals to porosify the city. I'm just going to show you very briefly what that means. It's so threatening, this technology. Porosity, it is. I'm over 60. I mean, you know, you have to be under 15 to really feel this. The first aspect about porosity is that it deals with edges. And edges come in two forms, borders and boundaries. That happens in nature. The work I did with some of my students at MIT, the cell membrane is a border. It's porous. But it has, whereas a cell wall is not so porous. Thing about this is that porosity is just not free flowing. A cell membrane is both porous and resistant. It tries to keep in the valuable ingredients in the cell and to exchange ingredients it doesn't need. The problem with the cell wall is in this cellulose fibers that we looked at is that no exchange is possible. So when we talk about porosity, we're not talking about openness in the sense that anything flows everywhere. We're talking about a very complex condition in nature. The same thing is true about ecological borders. This is another study we did in Provincetown, which is just off Boston. The places of greatest activity here, both biological and evolutionary, are where the water meets the land. Same thing about the layers of water in the ocean itself. It's at the edge where the most activity goes on in a natural ecology.
Excuse me.
And a hedgerow, you'll all know this as a familiar example of something which is mixed in that way. And so is very alive, much more alive than the mown spaces around it. By contrast, this is my favorite slide of everything I showed. These are tiger dropping border boundaries, and you know how they do it. They shit a warning set of warning signals here that this is for my group. No other tigers are allowed. Indeed, no other animals who know how to read these signals are allowed. Anyhow, so this distinction between borders and boundaries is fundamental in the natural world. It's also something that we can build. This is a photo I took of the Israeli security wall, which is the ultimate built boundary on one side. That's on the Israeli side. I couldn't get across the other side. The Israelis wouldn't let me go. But on the other side of this is a market made by Palestinians where they sell all sorts of things. You know, the wall in the morning offers them shade. And they have just this one little way to get through. But on the Israeli side, this is what I mean. This is a low-intensity edge. It's a wall. Walls themselves can function as borders. This is one in Avignon. This is where Jews, prostitutes, and Germans, what a combination, all clustered. They weren't allowed in the city center. I make no more further comment on that. And as you've seen in Ricky Burdett's original presentation to you, this is traffic is creating a border. Whereas this, in Sao Paulo, remember this town? This is what we took from that dizzying height, is a boundary. People can walk across this traffic. It's slow, whereas this is fast. And the edges are highly porous. You have to watch out because you're in Brazil, which means that your life is taken in your hands every time you get in the way of a bus. But it works as a border. This is, to me, the most profound kind of distinction between borders and boundaries we know. That is between the vertical and the horizontal. Everything above the ground plane here is isolated from it. Everything. And this is a huge problem in the making of almost all tall buildings. How do you make them porous up? We have some ideas about how to make them porous at the ground plane by putting in lots of doors, by getting rid of security codes to get into an elevator and so on. There are lots of ways to do it. But porosity is inachievable for us in almost all vertical dimensions. Now, I don't want to talk about it. This is a project I did in East London. Another way of making something porous is by changing its function. And there's a parking lot project where it's a parking lot, but we poured tons of sand on it so little kids are at the beach in this poor part of London. And to come back to this, this is a border in Mumbai. That is, lots of things happening both vertically and horizontally there. People are eating, their kids are upstairs whining or crying for mommy, who can go from ground floor up. It's also a space of production. And that's why I want to show you this. This is another kind of border in Mumbai. This is quite a frightening phenomenon. Does this thing work? Oh, yeah. The school, this is a block away from what I just showed you. The school for these kids crosses these train tracks. I don't know what your experience of Indian train schedules is. Yours sounds like yours is very regular. Mine was that these are quite irregular. And these kids have to treat this as a dangerous, porous border to get to and from school, which they go back into day after day, hour after hour during the day. So it develops kind of street smarts environmentally. And finally, I'll just show you this. The opposition between a border and a boundary spatially is something that is a continuity. This is Bogota's version of Nehru Place. People here, they have a lot of things that have fallen off the back of the truck for sale, and they're selling them on overturned cardboard boxes. If they prosper, they move up a floor, and they're still dealing in semi-legal goods, but the floors are now organized like streets, and they have customers who come to where they're shopping. I suppose the salesman on my iPhone has regulars to whom my iPhone wouldn't be sold. Anyhow, it's a cluster here. If you get up to the top floor, they've actually built, they've taken 4x8 sheets of cardboard and created miniature stores up there. What you're looking here is vertically rising from the porous to the non-porous, from the informal to the formal. This is what physically social mobility looks like. Understand what I'm saying? This is, social mobility is not just a statistical fact. It's a physical experience. Now, I've mostly showed you things from non-Western countries. I'll just show you very quickly how one of my masters, Aldo van Eyck, dealt with the problem of porosity. This is a space in Amsterdam with this huge, open traffic zone. What he did is he filled it in. And what's porous about this is that people barrel down this street, and these little kids are playing at the edge. Like the kids in Mumbai, they have to learn the street smarts about where you go and where you don't go. That is, they have to become visually safe. Health and safety would have never allowed this in Britain to be built. You have to segregate those kids away. You have to do the equivalent of shut them up in a boundary. Whereas the Van Eyck notion is they're learning the city by being at a border edge. Here's another one of these. This is a beautiful one. And they're everywhere. And there are 700 of these made in Amsterdam. They're all places of porosity. And the notion is that a porous city is a way you learn in your city. So what I'd like to say about this in sum is that if the public comes to demand it, we urbanists can design a porous city. Like Nehru Place, these other visions entail opening up and blurring the edges of spaces so that people are drawn in rather than repulsed. They're dangerous, they're ambiguous, they emphasize true mixed use of public and private functions. In British terms, schools or clinics amidst Tesco or Pret. They explore the making of loose-fitting spaces which can shift in shape as people's lives change. I don't believe that in design determinism, but I do believe that the physical environment should nurture the complexity of identity. That's an abstract way of saying that we know how to make a porous city. The time has come to make it. Thank you very much.
thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. Let's just talk. Try and get some exchange going between the two of you, and then let's open this up for wider discussion. I was just, I'd be interested in both your reactions to this, that I was very struck about how, about your images of the gated community, the protection of private space, which inhibits people kind of living out. And I was thinking about it, you know, personally in the context of the constituency that I represented for 23 years, where in the poorest parts of the constituency, what people long for is precisely that. You know, when the debate is about what you spend on a housing estate, what people want are entry phones. They want secure gates. They want a way of, if you like, sort of locking themselves in instead of living out. And this this sense of, which I think is incredibly attractive, of living out that you describe, is something which, in my experience, and I'd be very interested to hear other views, is something which is created by mixed communities, people from a range of social backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, age and experience. And that really is the absolute prerequisite, because it's that that creates a sense of safety. And safety is a sort of prerequisite to porosity and this sense of opening up that you describe. And, you know, I was interested in your references to Dharavi, because I've got to know, as you know, Dharavi quite well through the work I do with a charity which works in the communities there. And there are contradictions. You know, the contradictions are family shacks in which 10 people live, which are spotless, beautifully ordered, but where the order within the shacks is constantly threatened by crime. But there is plenty of living out, because there isn't enough space for 10 members of a family to live in. So, I mean, there are all sorts of contradictions here. And one of the contradictions, or the facts I think it's important to build, is the universality of the appeal of this, which builds on certain absolute prerequisites. One is safety. The second is actually a respect for property, what is mine and what is not shared. And then I think the third is the availability of space to live out. Now, and in, you know, which takes me, I think, to the final point, which is, you know, where is the state in this? And you see, the only state intervention in Dharavi is to spray the rubbish in the summer to keep the Anopheles mosquito, which brings malaria, at bay. But if you think of communities in our city, and I suspect in New York, what private places schools are when the kids aren't there, what private spaces PFI hospitals have become, where the community can't use them except by with the consent of those who own the school. So I think that I think that sort of empathetically, there's such enormous appeal and a sense of warmth in this. But underneath, there needs to be a discipline of organisation which realigns the relationship between the informal community and, if you like, the the property of the state, and it's the state that has to let go and trust the community.
Yes, I think the way I...
Do you want to think about that for a minute, and maybe Suketo, do you want to... I've had this bug, and I know how wretched you can
feel. No, it's all right.
I'm absolutely heroic.
Double whiskey. We'll see you later. No, I'll respond to you about this, and something you and I have talked about. And I'll respond to you in a very personal way about this. I grew up in a housing estate in America, unbelievably grungy. I guess what you call in this country a sink estate. It's called a place called Cabrini Green in Chicago, in which people lived behind locked doors, two or three of them. There was nobody out in the lawns of the estate. People were afraid to go up and down the elevators and
exactly.
So on. There were plenty of eyes on the street, you know, the Jane Jacobs thing, but there was nobody to see. And the city had abandoned us. It was really, I'm not very romantic about poverty. We were something they wanted to disappear in time. After 40 years, they tore down. It was a huge project. At one point, people in the community, since cops wouldn't go in, ambulances wouldn't go in, hired security guards to be out in these open spaces from 5 to 7 every night. And people, because they're armed, it's America, the security guards are armed, they're willing to shoot to kill, and, you know, it's not Britain. People felt safe to come out. Those 2 hours, which had formerly been sort of adolescent criminal playtime, became the least dangerous hours. And people learned
something. The least dangerous.
The least dangerous. Because there were people out and about.
Yeah, exactly.
And what disturbs me about housing for the poor, I could have showed you something that the World Bank did in Delhi, which was appalling, which is create housing for the poor, which replicates what went on in Cabrini Green. It shuts people up inside. It puts them, security is presented to them as a matter of a defeat of a boundary rather than porosity. So, I just say this personally, to me, this is an issue about people think, you know, if they've got 5 locks on their door, they're safe. But they're not. If there's nobody about and they get in the elevator, they're going to get mugged. Or walking on the street, going to a convenience store, they're going to get mugged because they're the only person on the street. But it's been sold to them that, for the poor, that a gated community will actually make them safer. So this, to me, this whole issue of security is a kind of, it's false, and it's a kind of very bourgeois notion of what makes people secure. That if they can only lock their doors and nobody can come in, that they'll be safe. With that, I have to say.
So I've spent a lot of time in Dharavi researching my book and then going back since. I've also spent a lot of time in the Brazilian favelas, particularly Rio, and I looked at the whole program of pacification. The difference between the Latin American and African cities and Indian cities is that we don't have drugs and guns. There is crime, and I've lavishly documented it in my book, but it tends to be more organized. You're not going to get mugged in a Bombay slum. You won't, get carjacked. So what happens in Dharavi is that most people leave their doors unlocked during the day and often at night too. So I remember going to a leather workshop in Dharavi, and the man who had, he lived in a 2-floor shack. And his workshop was on the ground floor. He had four stations where he hired people to make little leather goods, you know, purses and bags and so forth. And he lived with his wife and two children above the workshop. So he works 16-hour days, and he sees his kids for 10 or 15 minutes in between breaks, and there's a sort of downtime. He plays with them. And now the government, as you know, wants to demolish Dharavi, and there is this scheme that they've come up with called the Slum Rehabilitation Authority, under which if 70% of the people in an area designated as slum, and there's no heavier word in the English language than the word slum. Once you impose it on a group of people, they're finished. So if the residents of what the government designates as slum, 70% agree, then a builder can come in and demolish the entire neighborhood, community, and create luxury housing along with replacement housing for the poor. Now, I've looked at these replacement buildings, and I know you have too, Richard. And they repeat the worst mistakes of council housing elsewhere in the world. It's as if we are beginning from first principles. We've learned nothing of. So he told me that the government offered him a 270-square-foot flat, which has its own indoor toilet, which it doesn't have right now. And it's brick and mortar. It's not bad. But they're not giving me a workshop in the same building.
Yeah.
So if I want to see my kids, I'll have to commute for an hour. And as I walked around Dharavi, I realized that, you know, they've actually built a community there. And it's not easily transferable somewhere else into blocks of high-rises. And that community protects them against crime. So they leave their doors open. They know who their neighbors are. And in Bombay, this kind of anomie, alcoholism, drugs, you mostly see it in the transit or replacement housing for the slum dwellers who've been evicted from these places. So this narrative of crime, I've been seeing it, you know, in cities all over the world. In Lisbon, there's a place called Cabo dos Mouros, which is a group of people from Cape Verde, and I went over there. It's a piece of the city that the developers want because it's very central. So there's all these stories in the Lisbon papers about the crime in the barrio, in the tabloids of, you know, the police coming in and drug dealing in the barrio. And in all of these places, I think the narrative of the crime is much more lurid than the crime.
It's more lurid.
It's exaggerated. It's magnified. Then if you compare the statistics to the perception of crime, and we see that in the U.S. as well. I mean, as soon as the Black Lives Matter movement started going on, the police forces across the country started spreading a kind of propaganda about shootings increasing, you know, the streets being given over to groups of rioting young black men. And if you actually look at the statistics, New York has never been safer. So that perception of crime, I think, serves certain interests. And when we read these stories, we've got to be very careful about, you know, is it really the poor that want five extra locks on their door, or are they being convinced to put five extra locks to guard against some sort of unseen enemy?
Let's just think about how this sort of transition from the, if you like, the kind of anxious community is achieved to, we achieve a transition to the kind of porous community. Because, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Suketu. I think that there are many sort of geographic areas where the risk of crime is overstated. But it's also overstated by the people who live there because they feel unsafe. Right. And so there is this, there's, if you like, this cognitive dissonance. But the cognitive dissonance is very destructive of, you know, what the kind of Nehru Place kind of experience, Richard. And I mean, the fact is that, you know, all over this city, you know, in New York and so forth, there are communities that show this kind of resilience and ability to... I love the idea, you know, this minimising the importance of home because people live out more. And that is, you know, that is a very... It's a rather wonderful ambition. But I think the point is, it doesn't happen by chance that there's a contradiction. There's a contradiction between the impulse that creates it and the pretty clear discipline.
You know, I think one way to think about this, and I should have said this before, but one way to think about this is that we put, I think, too much... if we think that a porous city is going to make everybody mutually tolerant and they're going to be nice, you know, pet each other
rubbish.
It's rubbish.
Yeah.
But because we need to learn from why it's rubbish, which is that there are dimensions of urban order which are purely physical and which are nonverbal. And the kind of porosity that I think ensures a kind of urban order is a bodily comfort, being with people, in the midst of people who are different. It's something visceral. It's, you know, the hand extended to the stranger who's trying to get to work. In my experience, I mean, one of the things that's terrible about academic urbanism is it translates the physical into the verbal all the time. And there are lots of translations don't happen. People have a physical experience of the city. They have nonverbal knowledge, which they can't put into words. If you're comfortable being pressed up against somebody who is sweating profusely and you're in a carriage together, very familiar to any New Yorker in the subway, you're practicing a kind of civic order. But you couldn't put it into words.
Mm.
And I'd like to see urbanists concentrate more on what can't be represented or symbolized in the way of saying these, you know, talking about diversity, talking about community. I think these are things that are made with our body. You know, that's...
And the whole really comes from the agglomeration of fragments of behavior. I was observing exactly this week, getting on to, from the Northern Line, where you kind of bend over and you've got somebody's head in your armpit, to the Victoria Line, where queues form. And people, I mean, in this chaos, there is a kind of order about, you know, if you wear a backpack, which I do all the time, you take it off, because then one more person can get in. And the way people fit themselves into each other, I mean, that's a pretty universal experience of living in London every day. But let's open this up a bit. And have we got microphones? Let's invite your questions or your challenges or controversy to Suketu or to Richard. Yes, gentleman in the middle who's holding his...
That's you.
Yeah.
Hello. Thank you. Brilliant
talk. Speak up nice and loud so everyone can hear you.
Wonderful talk this evening. I feel very humble sitting here amongst the company. I have one question I'd like to put back to you, Suketu, with regarding to your three rules. Don't exclude anybody from the conversation. I say and ask that in relation to my own personal experience as a chairman for a residents association that is currently under proposal for a regeneration. We just don't seem to be getting anywhere talking to our housing association and feeling that our views are being heard. What could you propose in light of that?
So the question, as I understand it, is you're chairman of a residents association, but you're being excluded from the conversation of the housing association.
We're being condescended and patronised.
Yeah. Is the housing association wanting to do to you and your community things you don't want?
Yes. Well, I mean, for example, it's a hot potato at the moment, isn't it?
Right.
All over London, everybody's talking about regeneration. Yeah. I'm mindful of the fact that our estate needs it. You know, I don't deny that. It's undeniable. But I feel we're not part of the conversation. Our thoughts and views just aren't being actioned upon.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Well, this is where you start reducing London's livability index by democratic protest. I think if they're not, you know, letting you into the conversation, you have to live there, and so you have to take control of the conversation. And really, there is no other way other than democratic protest. This is where, if you look at community boards, my son in New York just became a member of the community board of Park Slope, and you know, he could have these meetings, and there is a role for the gadfly. I'm all in favor of gadflies. So go up to these meetings and, you know, declaim. And at the very local level, like the housing associations, this is where it's really inspirational to see democracy in action. So I'll give you an example. I've been following a group of, there's a South Asian housing rights organization in Queens. I once went with them to a building full of Bangladeshis in Woodside in Queens. And so it's a whole building full of recent immigrants. They're paying very high rents. The landlord is Greek, himself an immigrant. And I went to a meeting that the housing advocates had called. And so all the Bangladeshis got down in the lobby. And there was the Greek man, the landlord, in the back, you know, with his arms crossed, just watching the tenants as they were trying to organize themselves. And this young woman gave this incredibly stirring speech about the nature of democracy in the U.S. and how it really begins with this residents' association. So these are people from Bangladesh who come from a place of great political volatility, but they also understand that democracy, civic action, can get them things. And I went into their apartments and I saw the kind of accommodations that they had to make. So, for example, there was an air conditioner that had been left by the previous tenant, but the landlord wouldn't remove it. It had been painted shut into the window. So the residents put a big gift wrap around the air conditioner. So it stuck out, but it became, you know, part of the ornamentation. So there were many of these compromises, but ultimately what they wanted was to lower their rent, get services. And when this housing advocate went there and, you know, explained to them, brought them into the conversation of civic engagement, they mobilized and they took the landlord to court. Their rents got lowered, and in this case, there really is no substitute for legal action, civic engagement. That's what I think the whole Black Lives Matter movement is about, that. If you're not going to listen to us, then we'll make you listen to us. We'll stand out your window and shout as loudly as we can until you listen to us.
Yeah. Good. Okay. There you are. So who'd like to follow that? Yes. Can I see all the hands? Because we'll get as many as we can. Okay. We'll take your question, and then we're going to take all those contributions. Don't anybody else put up your hand, and then we'll be able to get responses to all those before 8 o'clock. Okay.
Okay, so my question is to Richard. Richard Sennett.
The one and only.
Yes. I know.
Although I would like to read.
Anyway, I really think this concept of porosity is a fantastically useful concept. And I loved seeing these illustrations of borders and boundaries. But what I was trying to understand is, are these borders and boundaries physically constructed, or are they also socially constructed? And they may not have any physical manifestation.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't put it as an either or. That in the case of the Van Eyck, that's an architect, a great, great architect, who has a social vision that children should learn the city and thinks, what could I do in making these parks to make these kids learn the city? How can I make them street smart? And there are physical means he does it. I don't think he ever... He was a very dour Dutch. I don't think he could play with a child to save his life. In that case, he enabled something physically to happen. And indeed, he pushed it that way by not, by leaving these edges unprotected. I don't think he was... What I'm saying about this is, we often think that, communities or environments that are design-driven are somehow against the way people live, they're not expressing people's way of life and so on, and that design should follow dwelling. I think that's just too simple. With gated communities, for instance, as a designer, I'd never do one of them. I think it's immoral to do that. It's something else, unethical to do it. But I think the object of design should be to take them down. Some ways you can do that are economic, by making housing and covenants which exclude people racially or religiously illegal. That's a way to create a boundary condition. Sometimes you can do it as has been done in some communities in Latin America, by getting, this is the great lesson of Bogota, by taking away highways and just physically letting the communities grow into each other. I mean, that's a physically driven design, but it has a social point. So I don't see it as an either or. What it takes is an urbanist who is not a servant of rich developers, but works with the people. But once you get to that condition, it's not neither or.
Mm. Right, thank you, Richard. Let's what we're going to do. You've got about 20 seconds each to make your point to change the world. And we'll move around quickly with the. Let's start over here. Okay.
Good evening. Thank you very much for both of your talks.
You'll need to speak up.
Okay. Hi. Thank you. One of the things that I would like to ask you both, Suketu and Richard, perhaps to play off against each other, is, Richard, I really theoretically enjoyed your idea of living out as a way of developing a porous city. But the part of me that has been harassed and had friends harassed by the police for being out had a heart attack. But I did think, Suketu, of your first rule of being able to be inclusive, which is to be inclusive amongst in the eyes of the law. And I wondered how you would both work together and to resolve those differences between living out and policing and the law.
Okay. Okay, let's go up to the right-hand side.
Yeah, we need to worry about time.
Okay. Yeah, the gentleman who's got his hand up. Actually, there are quite a few of them come to
the office. Tess, we can't do this because we have to leave here at 8.
At 8, okay, fine.
So, that's...
Thank you very much for your insights. I would just love to go back to the point about the narrative on crime and the narrative about porosity. I'm a planning student from UCL. I'm just wondering, how can we unwind this kind of false narrative to make people, to convince people that mixity and porosity are actually good things for a city? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Now, I've just been reminded that we actually have to be out by 8 o'clock, so I'm afraid we're going to take two more, and then we'll ask for final responses from Suketu and Richard. Woman right in the back row, and then have we got anybody in the middle block? Yes, and woman here, just keep your hand up.
Hi. You spoke about the vibrancy. You spoke about the vibrancy of poor areas, but I was wondering whether you thought there was any way that the people who are putting out that cultural capital of vibrancy to the poorer people could benefit from that, rather than just wealthy people who come in and have cheaper rents, but actually it costs the poorer people more and they don't really get a return.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay. Thank you very much. Final contribution.
Yeah, hi. Since this isn't talk about inclusion, I was just wondering, what are your views on kind of the refugee crisis, and how can we make sure that these people are included in cities? What's the kind of role of politics versus civil society?
Okay. Right. Thank you all. Suketu, do you want
to... It's a broad spectrum of questions, but I'll try to...
Especially solving the refugee crisis.
Yes, exactly. We'll do it tonight.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right about the vibrancy of poor areas. So one of the ways in which slums are blighted is by saying that they're economically unproductive. But anyone who walked into Dharavi knows that it's a site of tremendous production. It employs more people than the rich areas of the city. This is where... And there's all kinds of little industries. And it's not just in places like Dharavi. If you look at at music in areas of New York, where hip-hop's come from. I mean, hip-hop is a cultural product which brings real economic value to the country. The same sort of thing in the comunidades of Brazil. There's tremendously vibrant culture which translates in terms of money. The thing about... You made this, I think, very valid point that being a woman in a Bombay train or a porous community on a street, this risk of getting harassed, you're actually very grateful for police protection against some of these people who are, out to attack you. So I think that's there. we need security, whether it's private or public, and we need laws. So I grew up in a building in Jackson Heights in New York, which was... It's the most diverse neighborhood in the United States. And I grew up in a building full of Indians and Pakistanis, Haitians and Dominicans, Jews and Muslims. The building was owned by a Turkish man, and the super was Greek. So all of these communities, these were people who were killing each other just before they got on the plane. So what happens when they come to New York? It's not that we start loving each other. We said horribly racist things about everyone else in our own homes. But there was a central courtyard where all the kids played together. So there were a couple of factors at work. One was that we understood we were all there to make a better life for our kids. We didn't, but we were also sending money back to hate groups in our countries. But we couldn't act out on that hate in America because we realized here the law won't let us act on that hate. So this is the benefit of things like hate crime laws. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a role for a certain amount of state supervision. Mm. What else? Refugees. I mean, as I said, I think it's going to be the defining issue of the 21st century, this kind of mass migration.
Exactly, I agree.
And also because the other defining issue is the great surge of wealth upwards, the fact that there's the 80 richest people on the planet today own more than the bottom half of the world combined, mm-hmm. and it's only getting worse, that there's going to be a channeling of the outrage onto the refugees as we see massive numbers of people on the move. So we're going to have to find some way of accommodation, and I think that Tessa's read another piece that I've been writing where I talk about interlocals, that is people who are not nationalistic, but they have an allegiance to neighborhoods, to the neighborhood that they came from and the neighborhood that they're living. And it's a beautiful way of belonging where you don't have to be necessarily British or even a Londoner. You could have an allegiance to Islington or Brixton and also to Andheri in Bombay. And you move between these and your allegiance is to the local. So I think it's those local allegiances that might be the answer.
Richard?
Well, about this refugee thing, you bring up something that's very personally painful for me, because I worked in the UN in the 90s about resettlement of refugees in Lebanon, which had a 14-year civil war. The rates of displacement were like those in Syria today, which, by the way, I'd be amazed if it's less than a 14-year war. But what I learned about that, we made refugee camps because, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of people who were displaced, and we shouldn't have. We should have straight away gone into ways of filtering people into local shelters, using found spaces. We should not have these. The standard way of making a refugee camp is to use a military model. They're all orthogonal. They're very efficient provision of services. And they usually make the experience of being a refugee worse because you're completely isolated. And the big challenge, no, not in this country, because you're very ungenerous about refugees, horribly, but in Germany, not something to clap about, you'd be deeply ashamed of, but in Germany, which has been generous, the problem with dealing with those 680,000, that's our latest count, of refugees, is how to get them out of refugee camps. And the Germans are, I must say, it's really inspiring to me that they've understood that the whole problem is how to not incarcerate a refugee in the mentality of being other. And but I don't think, as a whole, Europe is going to manage it that way. The idea of porosity I have, I guess, is also built on that. That when you suffer a terrible wound like displacement, the thing you want to do is not be embraced, oh, poor suffering you, but to be absorbed into another culture where you can get on. You know, most refugees are incredibly hardy. These people who went across the sea into Greece, these aren't shrinking violets, you know. They're hardy. But for them, the politics of dealing with their situation is to get into an environment which is porous, rather than isolates them suffering other people. So thank you very much for your question. We made it.
Okay, so we finish on perhaps the biggest challenge to porosity. And can I just say thank you so much, Richard and Suketu. I mean, I think you've given us the most stimulating, optimistic, but also challenging presentation, and I think everybody's going to take that away with them and keep on thinking about it. This session is going to have a long afterlife. So can I thank all of you for your questions,
thank you.
For coming, and there we are. Thank you, Urban Edge.